This evening we're going to look at a couple chapters in the book of 2 Kings. 2 Kings chapter 6 and chapter 7. And I'm going to be reading from the New Living Translation. It's not my favorite study Bible, but I find it very easy to read when just reading through passages of the Bible. And this isn't a passage that we study very often. I'm sure we've heard it before, but maybe not, don't quite remember all the details. So this evening, I'm just going to go through the text here, make comments as I go through, and at the end of the lesson, we'll look at some things that we can learn from what is written here. So 2 Kings chapter 6, and starting in verse 8, and also just as a reminder, this is talking about Elisha and his interaction with the king of Israel and the Arameans. And just so to remind you guys, since we don't study Elijah and Elisha that often and they're easy to get confused, Elijah was the person, the prophet that came before Elisha. He's the one that we often know for doing a lot of the great big miracles, like going up to Mount Carmel and having the battle with all of the false prophets, or, you know, prophesying that the dogs would come and lick up Jezebel's blood, all of those big things that we know and remember. Elisha was the one that followed after him. He got to watch Elijah go up in the chariot. And a lot of the miracles and the things that he did were smaller in nature. They weren't quite on as big of a scale. Sometimes it was just something small, like at the beginning of this chapter, which I'm going to skip over, where there was the axe head that the guy had borrowed, and he was sorry, and so he made it float to the top of the water so that he could return it. So that's some background on this. So we're going to start reading in 2 Kings chapter 6 and verse 8, and I'll just go through a few verses at a time. Starting in verse 8, when the king of Aram was at war with Israel, he would confer with his officers and say, "We will mobilize our forces at such and such a place." But immediately Elisha, the man of God, would warn the king of Israel, "Do not go near that place, for the Arameans are planning to mobilize their troops there." So the king of Israel would send word to the place indicated by the man of God. Time and again, Elisha warned the king so that he would be on alert there. I'm just going to stop there for now. So here we've got the Arameans. They're at war with Israel. And every time the Aramean king tries to plan out his strategy for how to attack Israel, he gets there and he finds out that there aren't any Israelites there at all. And just over and over again, he keeps getting defeated and he's not doing any good. He just keeps moving around thinking he's got a good strategy and nothing happens. And so he starts getting upset about this. If we read in verses 11 and 12 here, we'll see what he does about that. The king of Aram became very upset over this. He called his officers together and demanded, "Which of you is the traitor? Who has been informing the king of Israel of my plans?" "It is not us, my lord the king," one of the officers replied. Elisha, the prophet in Israel, tells the king of Israel even the words you speak in the privacy of your bedroom. So here he starts accusing his own people of being a traitor, because that's naturally the first thing that you would think of if you're trying to conduct a war and it seems like the enemy knows every single move you're going to make before you even do it. And so he tries to find out, and one of them points out and says, it's not any of us. It's this prophet guy over in Israel. He keeps telling the king and letting him know where we're going to be. In fact, not only does he tell the king of Israel everything that you're going to do, but he also knows all of the things that you whisper about, even in your bedroom or closed places where nobody else can hear. That's how powerful of a prophet this man is. So that's just the first section I divided up, where the Arameans kind of learn of Elisha. They're finding out who he is. Starting in verse 13, we're going to see that they try to capture Elisha. If you have an enemy on the other side who's defeating you, then you want to try to take that person out or get them on your side. And so that's what the king of Aram tries to do in verse 13. He says, go find out where he is, the king commanded, so I can send troops to seize him. And the report came back, Elisha is at Dothan. So one night the king of Aram sent a great army with many chariots and horses to surround the city. When the servant of the man of God got up early the next morning and went outside, there were troops, horses, and chariots everywhere. Oh, sir, what will we do now? The young man cried to Elisha. So here the king says, find out where he is. They find out he's over in the town of Dothan, and they decide, all right, we're just going to go surround this city. We're going to capture this guy and put an end to this so that we can actually try to win this war. And apparently they did this at night, because when he wakes up in the morning, actually it's Elisha's servant wakes up first and gets to go outside, and all of a sudden he sees the entire armies all around him, surrounding him. So he says, what are we going to do? And so the Aramean army came to try to capture Elisha. And what we're going to read in the next verses is that Elisha ends up actually capturing the entire Aramean army, starting in verse 16. So after the servant asked him, what are we going to do? Elisha says, don't be afraid, for there are more on our side than on theirs. Then Elisha prayed, O Lord, open his eyes and let him see. The Lord opened the young man's eyes, and while he looked up, he saw the hillside around Elisha was filled with horses and chariots of fire. As the Aramean army advanced toward him, Elisha prayed, O Lord, please make them blind. So the Lord struck them with blindness, as Elisha had asked. So the first thing that Elisha says is, don't be afraid, tells the servant. And he prays to open his eyes. So here, this isn't a literal opening of his eyes, obviously. Elisha's servant wasn't blind. But he gives him kind of a spiritual vision, opens his eyes spiritually so that he can see just how powerful God is and how God is there to protect them and surrounding them, even more so than all of the enemy that's surrounding them. And then Elisha's second response, after he prays for this his servant, his second prayer, or his second response is also a prayer, and he prays to blind all of these men, the army that came to get them. And God answers both of those prayers immediately. Continue in verse 19. Then Elisha went out and told them, you have come the wrong way. This isn't the right city. Follow me, and I will take you to the man you are looking for. And he led them to the city of Samaria. So they came to get Elisha, and they don't realize it, but after he blinded them, they're talking right to him. And he tells them they need to follow him, and he leads them right into Samaria, which is where the king is, that we're going to find out, right into the capital city. So as they entered Samaria, in verse 20, Elisha prayed, O Lord, now open their eyes and let them see. So the Lord opened their eyes, and they discovered that they were in the middle of Samaria. When the king of Israel saw them, he shouted to Elisha, my father, should I kill them? Should I kill them? Of course not, Elisha replied. Do we kill prisoners of war? Give them food and drink and send them home again to their master. So the king made a great feast for them and sent them to their master. After that, the Aramean raiders stayed away from the land of Israel. So Elisha, through God's help, is able to not only keep the Arameans from capturing him, but he leads them right into the capital city where they could have done anything. They could have taken them prisoners of war. They could have killed them all on the spot. They could have done anything because he just led the whole army there right into their midst. And instead, he doesn't kill them like the king is kind of excited to do here. He feeds them and he sends them home. He doesn't even hold on to them. But we can see that the Arameans came with their intent to capture Elisha, and with God's power, he actually ended up capturing them. If you're wondering, this is a map to kind of give you an idea of where the places are. So we're talking about the Arameans who are from the north, up in Aram. Most of you know Samaria is kind of in the center part of Israel there, and then Dothan is just a little bit north of that. So the Arameans would have been coming down to Dothan to get Elisha, and then he led them down into Samaria there, and then they went home. Let's continue reading in verse 24 here. That was the Israel or the Arameans' first encounter with Elisha. Now it's going to kind of turn to their whole interaction with Israel as a country. So verse 24, sometime later, remember in verse 23 there, it said that after this happened, the Arameans stayed away, but obviously that lasted for a period of time, but not forever, because we find out that they come back. Sometime later, however, King Ben-Hadad of Aram mustered his entire army and besieged Samaria. As a result, there was a great famine in the city. The siege lasted so long that a donkey's head sold for 80 pieces of silver and a cup of dove's dung sold for 5 pieces of silver. And I'm sure most of you already know, but when you lay siege to a city or besiege it, you're just camping around it. The idea is to cut off any trade in and out of the city. So you can't, you know, after a while, it's like Walmart running out of food once, or the grocery store, there's no trucks coming in and out. You know, if you completely lock down the city, eventually they're going to run out of supplies, out of food. And it happened long enough that when they ran out of food, then there's these things like a donkey's head or dove's dung that are selling for ridiculous prices that only the rich can afford. So that's how bad it's getting. In verse 26, and one day, as the king of Israel was walking along the wall of the city, a woman called to him, "Please help me, my lord the king." He answered, "If the Lord doesn't help you, what can I do? I have neither food from the threshing floor nor wine from the press to give you." But then the king asked, "What is the matter?" So he sees this woman as he's walking around the city, and she asks for his help, and his first response is, "You know, I've got nothing." It's not like all of us that are rich and noble are feasting and we're starving you guys. I don't have any more bread than you do. And it seems like there's no response from her, and I think he realizes that she still has something to say, so he just says, "What's the matter?" And she says, "This woman said to me, 'Come on, let's eat your son today, and then we will eat my son tomorrow.' So we cooked my son and ate him. Then the next day I said to her, 'Kill your son so we can eat him.' But she has hidden her son." When the king heard this, he tore his clothes in despair, and the king walked along the wall. The people could see that he was wearing burlap under his robe next to his skin. "May God strike me and even kill me if I don't separate Elisha's head from his shoulders this very day," the king vowed. So this is obviously a pretty dire circumstance, to the point where these women are willing to eat their own children to stay living. And the one woman's complaining not because they had to eat their children, but because of this unfairness that's going on where they ate her son and the other woman's not holding up her end of the deal to share. And so the king's obviously distressed, and he seems like he decides that the problem is with Elisha, and he blames Elisha for what's going on with this famine and with all of these horrible things that are happening. He's probably thinking, if Elisha would have just killed all those people that came in here before, he let them right into the city, if he would have let me kill them like I wanted, then we could have ended this, we wouldn't have had to worry about the siege, we wouldn't have had all of this famine and all of this hunger and people dying. So he makes a vow that he's going to go behead Elisha this very day. So he heads over to Elisha's house in verse 32. Elisha was sitting in the house with the elders of Israel when the king sent a messenger to summon him. But before the messenger arrived, Elisha said to the elders, "A murderer has sent a man to cut off my head. When he arrives, shut the door and keep him out. We will soon hear his master's footsteps following him." So the one problem with going to see a prophet is that if he's on God's side, he's going to know when you're coming. And so he's telling his servant, warning him that the king and his messenger's coming. And actually, while he's telling his servant this, in verse 33, the messenger actually arrived. So he's sitting at home talking with some elders, and just says this, and you know, in the couple sentences that it takes for this to come out of his mouth, the messenger gets there, and he probably got the door closed just in time. and the king's right behind him. I don't know why he even bothered sending a messenger, because it almost sounds like the messenger was there, and within a couple more minutes, the king is there. He's so mad, he's coming himself. So verse 33, when Elisha was still saying this, the messenger arrived, and the king said, "All this misery is from the Lord. Why should I wait for the Lord any longer?" If we go over to chapter 7, Elisha replies, he says, "Listen to this message from the Lord. This is what the Lord says. By this time tomorrow, in the markets of Samaria, 5 quarts of choice flour will cost only 1 piece of silver, and 10 quarts of barley grain will cost only 1 piece of silver." The officer assisting the king said to the man of God, "That couldn't happen, even if the Lord opened the windows of heaven." But Elisha replied, "You will see it happen with your own eyes, but you won't be able to eat any of it." So this is a pretty profound response. You would think that when the king comes and he's mad at Elisha and accuses him and even the Lord, saying the Lord's not going to help us, he's almost saying that God's forsaken them. And Elisha's response is, "Well, tomorrow all your problems will be solved. There's going to be food, and it's going to be so plentiful that the prices are going to drop to where you can get, you know, regular food for a piece of silver." And this officer, I'm not sure if it's the same messenger that came right before the king or if it's somebody else that came along with them, but this officer that was assisting the king said obviously didn't believe. He's saying there's no way this is going to happen. You know, even if God opened up heaven and just sent food flying down like the manna, there's no way this would happen. And so Elisha says, you know, you'll see it, but you're not going to be able to eat it. And just kind of keep that in the back of your mind, because that's going to come into play at the very end of the story. So that's the return to the Arameans coming back to besiege Samaria. I need to read a couple more verses, 3 and 4. "Now there were 4 men with leprosy sitting at the entrance of the city gates. 'Why should we sit here waiting to die?' they asked each other. 'We will starve if we stay here. But with the famine in the city, we will starve if we go back there. So we might as well go out and surrender to the Aramean army. If they let us live, so much the better. But if they kill us, we would have died anyway.'" So their logic makes sense. They're lepers. They're already stuck at the edge of the city because they can't go into the city. Everybody's on the point where they're getting to be at the point where they're getting close to dying anyway. And so they figure, we might as well go and join the Arameans, or, you know, at least if they take us as slaves, whatever, at least we'll be alive. If they feed us anything, it'll be more than what we have here. So it makes sense. So they decide to go over to the enemy's army. You know, even if they do kill him, they are going to die anyway. But we learn about something surprising here in verse 5. It says, "So at twilight they set out for the camp of the Arameans," this being the lepers that were going out there. This would be the following day, right after Elisha had made that prophecy. But when they came to the edge of the camp, no one was there. For the Lord had caused the Aramean army to hear the clatter of speeding chariots and the galloping of horses and the sounds of a great army approaching. "The king of Israel has hired the Hittites and the Egyptians to attack us," they cried to one another. So they panicked and ran into the night, abandoning their tents, horses, donkeys, and everything else as they fled for their lives. So here again we see that with the power of God, the Arameans who came to capture not just Elisha, but the entire city of Samaria this time, are again fleeing and running away through God's power. Just miraculously hearing, causing them to hear the sounds like multiple armies are coming at them. So the lepers get there and they find nobody there. The camp's deserted and there's all of the supplies. They've left everything there. When the lepers arrived at the edge of the camp, they went into one tent after another, eating and drinking wine, and they carried off silver and gold and clothing and hid it. Finally, they said to each other, "This is not right. This is a day of good news, and we aren't sharing it with anyone. If we wait until morning, some calamity will certainly fall upon us. come on, let us go back and tell the people at the palace. So they went back to the city and told the gatekeepers what had happened. We went out to the Aramean camp, they said, and no one was there. The horses and donkeys were tethered, and the tents were all in order, but there wasn't a single person around. Then the gatekeepers shouted the news to the people in the palace. This is the last section here where Israel collects the plunder. So remember again that the lepers couldn't go into the city. So when they finally do find this good news and they go back to tell people, they have to just tell the gatekeepers because they still can't go into the city. And the gatekeepers tell everyone. And of course, if you're in a city where the famine is as bad as it is, you know, news that there's a whole army full of food just waiting outside of the city is going to spread like fire. The lepers obviously get some food and are having a good time, and then they realize that they need to go back and tell everyone. So the rest of the chapter is about the rest of Israel going and getting that plunder. It says in verse 12, the king got out of bed in the middle of the night and told his officers, I know what has happened. The Arameans know we are starving, so they left their camp and have hidden in the fields. They are expecting us to leave the city, and then they will take us alive and capture the city. So the king's worried here. He's thinking, this is way too good to be true. There's no way that they just left. And, you know, this has got to be a strategy, some kind of a tactic on their part, so that when we go out there and we're just running, trying to eat as much as we can, they're going to just come in and slaughter us all and finish us off. So one of his officers has this great idea. He says, we'll send out scouts and check into this in verse 13. Let them take 5 of the remaining horses. If something happens to them, it will be no worse than if they stayed here and died with the rest of us. So the solution is send out a couple, handful of people, find out if this is really the case. And notice it says 5 of the remaining horses. You can't help but wonder if some of the horses were eaten just like the kids, that there's only a handful of animals left as well at this point. That's how bad it's gotten. And so again, it's the same reasoning that the lepers had. You know, if we're going to die here, we might as well send some people out and just make sure that they're not going to finish us all off. Because they're all at the point of death anyway. So in verse 14, so 2 chariots with horses were prepared, and the king sent scouts to see what had happened to the Aramean army. They went all the way to the Jordan River, following a trail of clothing and equipment that the Arameans had thrown away in their mad rush to escape. The scouts returned and told the king about it. Then the people of Samaria rushed out and plundered the Aramean camp. So it was true that 5 quarts of choice flour were sold that day for 1 piece of silver, and 10 quarts of barley grain were sold for 1 piece of silver, just as the Lord had promised. If you remember the map, with Samaria kind of halfway between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River, there's roughly 20 miles or so in between there. So it looks like when the Arameans ran home, they headed over to the Jordan River, crossed over, and then went up north. And so when these 5 when the scouts that had they sent out went to look into the situation, they went all the way over to the Jordan, those 20-ish miles or so, and they just see this trail of stuff. Even the stuff that the Arameans had left, they still had stuff on them, and they're just kind of ditching stuff and running as fast as they can to get out of there. So they follow that trail all the way to the Jordan. And then the people go out, they plunder the camp, and it's true what Elijah had prophesied through God about the price of the food. So that gets us down to verse 17, almost at the end here. The king appointed his officer to control the traffic at the gate, but he was knocked down and trampled to death as the people rushed out. So everything happened exactly as the man of God had predicted when the king came to his house. So here, this kind of sounds like a sad ending to this story. You know, all of a sudden there's this God provides for his people and they go running out, but this one guy that the king had set to kind of control the traffic at the gate gets trampled on because there's just a mad rush. People are so hungry to get outside. But we're going to find out an important detail in a second here. In verse 18, the man of God had said to the king, "By this time tomorrow, in the markets of Samaria, 5 quarts of choice flour will cost 1 piece of silver, and 10 quarts of barley grain will cost 1 piece of silver," as we remember. The king's officer had replied, "That couldn't happen, even if the Lord opened the windows of heaven." And the man of God said, "You will see it happen with your own eyes, but you won't be able to eat any of it." And so it was, for the people trampled him to death at the gate. So we remember the man who doubted God and Elisha's prophecy when he said that he would be able to see all of the food but wouldn't be able to eat it. It was that same man that got put at the gate who the people trampled and killed running out the door, out the gate trying to get to the food. And that was the punishment. So everything that God had said through Elisha came to pass. So let's look at a couple of lessons to learn here about this, what we've just been reading. First of all, God often protects us in ways that we can't see. Remember when the Arameans came to capture Elisha there, and his servant got up in the morning and saw all of the armies around him and said, "What are we going to do?" It seemed like, from human eyes, just looking at the situation, it seemed like it was going to be impossible to escape. There was no way that situation was going to end very well. And yet, God protected them. He was there, and Elisha saw that. His servant didn't see it at first. But when Elisha had prayed to God to give him the spiritual, to open his eyes spiritually, he was able to see how God was there to protect him. Also, Elisha had compassion on his enemies instead of killing them. When he led the Aramean army into downtown Samaria, where the king was, where their capital city was, the king was all excited. Remember, "Hey, Elisha, can we kill him? Can we kill him?" And Elisha didn't do that. He easily could have, but he had compassion on his enemies. And instead of killing them, he fed them and sent them home, which would be almost unheard of. Even today, you don't do that when you capture prisoners of war. You hold on to them and make trades. Also, sometimes God's people will suffer with those who have disobeyed God. And I need to explain this a little, because when I first read through this, I thought, why did this famine happen? We didn't read about anything that the people had done where they sinned against God, and so he brought this famine on them. So I thought, well, you know, it's not like every time that something bad happens that God is punishing the people, so maybe they hadn't done anything wrong. And this is just some way that God was testing them, or, you know, God has a good reason for everything that he does. But then I found this verse back in the law, back in Deuteronomy chapter 28, and I just have some verses here from verses 45 through 57. But I'll read through parts of it. Starting in verse 45, it says, "If you refuse to listen to the Lord your God and obey the commands and decrees he's given you, all these curses will pursue and overtake you until you are destroyed. These horrors will serve as a sign and warning among you and your descendants forever. If you do not serve the Lord your God with joy and enthusiasm for the abundant benefits you have received, you will be left hungry, thirsty, naked, and lacking in everything. The Lord will bring a distant nation against you from the end of the earth, and it will swoop down on you like a vulture. They will leave you no grain, new wine, olive oil, calves, or lambs, and you will starve to death." And so far you may think, well, yeah, this sounds like a normal promise of God's vengeance if they disobeyed, but look at some of the details here. He's talking specifically about a siege. "The siege and terrible distress of the enemy's attack will be so severe that you will eat the flesh of your own sons and daughters, whom the Lord your God has given you," which is exactly what we read. "The most tender-hearted man among you will have no compassion for his own brother, his beloved wife, and his surviving children. He will refuse to share with them the flesh he is devouring, the flesh of one of his own children, because he has nothing else to eat during the siege and terrible distress that your enemy will inflict on all your towns. And again, that talks about the most tender-hearted, delicate woman, that she will hide from them, she will hide her children so that she herself can secretly eat them. She will have nothing else to eat during the siege and terrible distress that your enemy will inflict on all your towns. Everything that all of this punishment that God's listing is so detailed to what was happening here, it almost seems like this was the result of something that they had done, even though we don't read about it. And if you read, if you think back to that story where the woman killed her son and the other woman was hiding her son, my first thought when I read that story was, well, of course she's going to hide her son. She doesn't want to kill him. But this almost makes it sound like the woman that hid her son and didn't want to share it was keeping her son to herself so that she could eat her entire son without having to share half of her son. That's how bad it was. And so my point was just that even though it seems like this was God's punishment, I'm sure not everyone in that city had sinned. And so sometimes we as God's people may end up suffering even with those who deserve the punishment. At least in this world, everything will be fair on the judgment day. This particular quote was not anything I had. It was something I read, and it was written so well that I just wanted to share it as is because it was a great lesson. It says, "The lepers rightly enjoyed the miracle God provided, but they also realized that the gift gave them a responsibility to share it with others. They understood that to remain silent and to selfishly enjoy their blessings would be sin. They had a responsibility to share the good news." And if anything, I think this is one of the most powerful lessons we can get from this story, that if you remember, the lepers, when they went out to receive the plunder, they were eating, they're drinking, they're enjoying it, all of that. But after a while, they realized, we can't just sit here. It's wrong for us to eat all of this when our brothers and sisters are inside starving. And they said, even to the point, if we wait even just till tomorrow, something bad's going to happen to us because we really need to go share this. And that applies to us today, as this is so clearly written, that we have an even greater blessing. If the lepers realized it was sin to be selfish and take all of the food and the clothing and all of the resources from that army that were just merely physical belongings, how much greater of a sin is it for us to receive God's spiritual blessings, to be Christians, and to not share that good news with everyone else? Just a couple final points. Never doubt God's word, no matter how ridiculous it may sound. There was the man who Elisha told, when Elisha made the prophecy that tomorrow the price of food will be so great that, or there will be so much food that the price will go way down, the man immediately thought this could never happen. Even if some great miracle like God giving us manna happened, it just wouldn't happen. And I'm sure at first Elisha's servant probably thought, there's no way we're getting out of this when the whole army surrounded them. But God is more powerful than sometimes we think or give him credit for. And no matter how ridiculous God's promises may sound, he is always true. Everything that he said, that was my last point, everything that God says or said came to take place. Whether it was the price of the food coming down to in such a short time, or the timing it happened overnight, just like Elisha said, the next day. It didn't take a week, it didn't take a month, even though that would have been amazing in and of itself. And the officer who doubted, Elisha said, you will see it, but you won't eat of the reward. Everything that God said happened, and it happened exactly as he said it. So I hope these thoughts have been helpful to you. 2 Kings chapter 6 and 7, not something that we read about a whole lot, but everything that is written in God's word is written for a purpose, and we can benefit from the lessons that are learned in there. this lesson has helped you in any way, or if it's got you thinking, it hasn't been the kind of lesson that tells you how to become a Christian or how to partake of those blessings as we talked about. But we would like everyone to be able to share those blessings. We don't want anyone to be stuck in the city where they're starving. Everyone should have the ability to, or the chance, the opportunity to be able to enjoy those blessings. And if you're a Christian here, I'd encourage you to share the good news. Remember what those lepers said. They realized that it would be sinful to partake of those blessings and to not share them with others. And so it is the same with us, that we need to be sharing God's blessings and the good news that He has with everyone. If we can help you in any way or pray with you, would you come forward as we stand and sing?